Thank you, Howard. Is this turned on? Do I need to? It is. It's working. Okay. Now, this is weird. I was told this was going to be an informal discussion, and I was feeling a little bad because I actually did bring a talk over, but was kind of expecting that I'd rely on it loosely and also be available to debate issues, discuss issues with you. I'd like to try to do that anyway if we could, and so I want to just invite everybody to interrupt freely as I'm going on with questions or observations or arguments, either based on stuff I'm saying now or based on stuff that's in the readings. In general, what I'd like to discuss with you today is two things. First of all, have a substantive discussion about number. These aren't, by the way, aren't in chronological order. We'll be doing them both at once. One is to have a substantive discussion about number development and what are the basic concepts of number that kids have when they begin school. What does schooling do with those concepts? How can we think about the foundations of our numerical and the nature of our numerical abilities? The second is a more general idea, though, and this was an idea behind the reading that I gave you, which was only partly about number. And that is that when you think about education, you think about, first of all, a phenomenon that's uniquely human. In fact, uniquely the province of humans who are old enough and capable enough to communicate through language and various other symbolic means. And you think of education as a way of extending and building our uniquely human symbolic abilities. And I will not be denying any of that. I mean, I think that's completely true. On the other hand, I also think it's true that what gives rise to these uniquely human abilities and what educators have to build on when they use them are a set of core cognitive capacities that are present in humans long before they become capable of any kind of formal instruction and that are present in the living world, were present in the living world long before there were humans, okay, that systems that evolved before we did and that continue to serve as building blocks for our thinking. Now, I tend to call these systems of core knowledge, and I've been interested both in their positive properties and in some of their limits. I start out here with a list of a few of their limits. These are not general purpose systems for thinking and reasoning about anything in the world, solving any cognitive task that we or someone else might want to set for ourselves. Rather, they're systems that function to represent and support learning about particular kinds of entities like solid manipulable objects versus human agents versus locations in the continuous spatial layout and so forth. They're also task-specific, that is, they function to serve particular kinds of cognitive ends and aren't just generally available for any new task that you might set for yourself. They're encapsulated in Jerry Fodor's sense, and I gather Fodor's been in the readings, right, so the notion of encapsulation is familiar. It's also, of course, hotly debated. I'll be using it in a sense that I hope sidesteps the major debates, just to mean that these systems privilege certain kinds of information about the environment at the expense of other kinds of information that are perfectly detectable by people, usable by people for other purposes, but don't seem to have much effect on the core system. So they're relatively restricted in their inputs. Now, one thing that Fodor denied, but that I think research suggests is true, is that these systems are also relatively restricted in their outputs. So Fodor's picture is that you have these different modular input systems and they all send representations to a single unified language of thought where they become available to interact with each other at will. It seems to me, and I think number provides a good example of this, so I'll be talking about this today, that in fact the core systems that we're endowed with give rise to outputs that are also relatively restricted in their range of application initially, though we also have means of overcoming those restrictions. And finally, as I said at the beginning, these are common to humans and other animals, at least non-human primates. In the case of number, the systems seem to be common to a much broader range of animals, and they're common to infants and adults. present in us as infants, and they don't go away. So what I'm going to be suggesting is that we continue to have these systems throughout life, that much of our cognitive abilities depend on them directly, but some of our most interesting cognitive abilities don't depend on them directly. They depend on them indirectly because these the representations that are delivered by core systems serve as the building blocks on which we construct new concepts and new cognitive skills. Those are the main points I want to get across. A subsidiary point has to do with how do we bring different core systems together and construct new things out of them. And as I suggested in the paper that you read, I think that natural language is playing a major role here. But what I want to do today, that's the most controversial thing I'll say, is, well, actually, that's probably not true. Probably lots of controversial things today. But that's the one that I get the most fights with people about. And it's the one that I think is least central. That is, if you want to understand how do people acquire new skills, you can remain open on the question, is language crucial to this ability, or is there some more general symbolic function of which language is just a special case that allows us to do this? You can remain neutral on that. What I hope to convince you of is that if we want to understand that, one of the things we have to understand are these basic building block core systems that develop before a child has a clue what a natural number is, that schools exist before a child is ready for any kind of formal mathematics education. They already have these core systems, and those systems are going to be doing major work for them in constructing new number concepts. So that's the general idea. The case study today will be number, and is the fact that you guys are discussing number in a section mean that people have read other stuff on number that I can just refer to? Piaget?
Not on number.
Wynn? Karen Wynn's work?
Well, it's summarized both in your writings and Carrie's. I would.
Yeah.
So when you say a word, put a modifying clause after it, and that'll help people.
All right. Okay. Now, I just wondered whether I was going to be able to skip stuff because you guys are experts on it already. But I'll just keep going.
It's a very fast-moving train. That's the reason.
Okay. I won't assume anything then, but, you know, you can just kind of move me along if I'm going over too familiar ground. Okay. So what's the plan for today? I want to talk about two different core knowledge systems for which I think there's now robust evidence from studies both of human infants and of non-human primates, and for that matter from studies of adults. One is a system for tracking small numbers of objects and keeping track of how many objects are in a scene exactly. And the other is a system for assessing approximate large numerical magnitudes, assessing the approximate cardinal value of a set of entities where the set is too large for us to be tracking each of the individuals. So I'll start out by talking about those two systems, then talk about how children might build a new system of number representation, the natural numbers, and then turn to some work on adults and adult natural number concepts and ask, can we make sense of what processes we go through when we represent, when we entertain a concept like seven, in terms of these systems of core representations and these constructions that children go through when they're about 4 years of age and first, we think, acquire the concept seven. Okay, so let me start out with the system for representing objects. I worked on this system for years before I had a clue that it had anything to do with number representations, and of course worked on it along with many other people who've worked on it using a variety of different methods. People, you're probably all familiar with preferential looking methods for getting at object representation, and also maybe predictive reaching methods, you know, this ability that even very young babies have when an object moves through a scene to predict where it's going to be in the future so that they can aim their reach ahead and intercept the object, and expectancy violation methods of the Baillargeon sort, where you get at what infants perceive and understand about objects by making objects do unexpected things and seeing how they react to those. Well, these methods have been used convergently to look at a variety of different abilities, from perceiving an object as a unit to representing an object when it goes out of sight and extrapolating its motion, and what will be most important for us today, tracking that object through space and over time and maintaining a representation that very object is in a scene at different places and at different times. So summarizing wildly over lots of this work, I think it provides evidence that babies construct spatiotemporal representations of objects, and that these representations give them at least one piece of numerical knowledge. They have some numerical content. They allow babies to represent the distinction between numerically distinct individuals. And let me just go over some very old studies undertaken that don't have the word number in them, just to illustrate this point. Okay, so there have been lots of studies asking about perception of object boundaries. When you put one object on top of another and let them undergo relative motion, do babies see a boundary between the top object and the bottom one? But the basic method that's used in all of those studies is to use either patterns of reaching or patterns of preferential looking, which both, by the way, give the same answers in these studies, to ask babies, in effect, how many things are in this scene? Is there one thing or are there two things? So, for example, the research by Al Yonis showed that when babies are about 5 to 6 months of age, they will only reach for a single object at a time. If there's multiple objects in a scene, they'll direct their reaching just to one of them. And in fact, if they're holding one object and another interesting object enters the scene, before they'll reach for the second object, they'll drop the first one. So they seem to be focused only on a single object. And so Yonis and others use that reaching pattern to ask, is an array like this seen as a single object, in which case the baby should reach for the whole thing, or two distinct objects, in which case they should reach for one or the other, but not both at once. Okay. So these studies are telling us something about perception of boundaries and internal connectedness. They're telling us something about perception, that you've got two numerically distinct individuals here. Another set of studies that I think does the same thing or related thing are studies of perception of partly occluded objects, mostly done with preferential looking methods, though there's starting to be some work with reaching methods as well, in which infants are shown an object whose center is hidden by an occluder until they're bored with it. And then their perception of what's going on behind the occluder is tested by taking the occluder away and either presenting one connected object or two separated ones. And under a variety of conditions, babies will look longer if you perceive two separated ones. I think this is also a task where, in effect, what the baby's being asked is, what's back here? Is there one thing back here, or are there two things back here? And babies are good at answering that question. If you ask them a more specific question, as Lincoln Creighton and René Baillargeon have done, if you ask, what's the shape of the thing back here? What's the color of the thing back here? Babies seem to give an indeterminate answer. They don't seem to have specified that. But as long as you give them a choice between one object and two spatially separated ones, then they seem to, their looking patterns provide evidence for a perception of a unitary object. And the issue of how many objects are in a scene is, I think, clearest in studies in which objects move completely out of view. So here's one that I did some time ago, I guess almost 10 years ago, that was subsequently picked up by Susan Carey and Fei Xu and used in a whole series of studies. What we did was take an object, move it out of sight behind a screen, and then take an object that looked just like it and move it into sight from behind another screen, and contrast infants' reactions under two conditions. In one condition, this thing was seen to move between the two screens. In the other condition, it wasn't. And the question to babies again was, how many things are there here? Is there one? Or are there two identical twins? And babies' patterns of looking at subsequent displays where you took the screens away and there's either two objects or there's one provided evidence that they saw two in this case where there was no pattern of continuous motion across the scene, and one in a case where there was a pattern of continuous motion. So in all these cases, babies seem to be parsing arrays into objects and representing the distinction between an array that contains one object and an array that contains two, whether it's a distinction that that's present in at a given moment of time in a spatially interesting array, or over time in an array where things move in and out of view. It looks like babies have these abilities. Now, I've already suggested that there's also evidence for some striking limits to these abilities, and I think the most interesting limits were discovered by Shu and Carrie. Did Susan talk about this work in here? No. Okay, I'll talk about Susan's work. I'll actually be talking about Susan's work a lot today. So they repeated some of the studies that we had done with objects that move. So, for example, one object I showed you before, a diagram, one object sitting on top of another undergoing relative motion. But instead of having the objects move, they were simply stationary, and they used familiar, recognizable kinds of objects. These were for 10-month-old babies. We know from work by Jean Mandler and others that well before 10 months, you can show a baby an object like this, and they'll represent it as something like a toy animal. You show them an object like this, and they'll go vroom, vroom, and represent it as something like a toy vehicle. Put the two together and just ask, is there one thing here, or are there two things, using the same methods as the studies that I just showed you before? And the answer is indeterminate, okay? At 10 months, babies don't have a determinate perception between two things and one thing, okay? By 12 months, they do. By 10 months, they do if you introduce relative motion. That's just a replication of the studies I showed you from a slide back, okay? With relative motion, babies use that spatiotemporal information to parse the array into two units. But in the absence of relative motion, they're not using properties of the objects or knowledge that they otherwise seem to have about the kinds of objects that are being presented as a basis for determining how many entities are in this array. Do we have two numerically distinct individuals or only one? And the same conclusion follows from a study that Shu and Carrie did that was very related to the one that I showed you with the two screens, where the idea is at any given time they only see one object emerge from behind the screen. But sometimes it's a duck that emerges, and then that goes back, and then a truck comes out. And the question to the baby is, how many things are in this scene? Can they use the features that distinguish the truck and the duck? Or what they know about the categorical difference between a toy animal and a toy vehicle to determine how many objects are in the scene? And the answer is, when they're 12 months old, yes. But when they're 10 months old, no. Okay? So it looks like early on, babies are failing to use property kind information. And I think this is sort of the first hint that this system for representing objects is a relatively encapsulated system. It's using spatiotemporal information. Information about how things are moving. Is something moving on a continuous path? Are two parts of the scene moving rigidly together, as in the case of the center occluded object? Are two things that are touching each other moving independently, as in the case of the object sitting on top of each other? They can use all that kind of information to represent an array of numerically distinct objects. They don't seem to be using property information, categorical information, and so forth, at least not until about 11 or 12 months of age. Now, most of the studies that were done on object perception were done 10 or 20 years ago, and they generated lots of controversy. I was very proud of my contribution to this. I thought, boy, we've really shown that babies are fancy creatures. They have lots of abilities. They can do lots of things. And then other people came along and said, no, this can't be right. There's got to be simpler explanations. I think recent developments in recent years suggest this whole debate was a little bit odd. Odd for people to be skeptical of these abilities, but also odd for people like me to be so proud of what we found, that all these great things that babies can do, for the simple reason that if you look at any number of other animal creatures, they not only can do what the babies can do, they leave human infants in the dust. They can do so much more for all of these abilities. There have been a number of labs that have been looking recently at one-day-old chicks. The question is, you can take the same kinds of experiments that we did with human infants and do them with one-day-old chicks and ask, do chicks have capacities to represent objects? Now, I don't know whether you can do preferential looking on a chick, but you don't have to. You can use imprinting methods. You know, most of the studies of object perception really relied on the first of the three methods that I had up a few slides ago, the one where you just present babies with something until they're familiar with it, familiar enough with it that it's no longer very exciting, and now look to see if they'll look longer at something new. So they're really relying on the fact that infants will distinguish something familiar from something new, and in a looking time study, they show they've made that distinction by showing a novelty preference, looking longer at the new thing. Well, the imprinting literature provides a different method for asking whether a chick can distinguish something familiar from something new, because we know that if you take a chick at birth, put them in an environment where there aren't any other living conspecific potential moms around, right? So actually they don't have other chicks that they're raised with. They don't have a mother hen that they're raised with. They're simply in an environment by themselves. And if you put in that environment a single object of just about any sort that moves, the chicks will take that object to be mom. They'll become familiar with it and imprinted to it. And you can see the effects of that imprinting. If you subsequently put them in a novel environment where they're relatively stressed, and you put that object at one corner, they will gravitate towards it. Okay? So the chicks, just like the human infants, will distinguish between something they've never seen before and something they've been shown repeatedly. It's just that for the chicks, the way to see that distinction is to present that object repeatedly under conditions that give rise to imprinting, and then look to see that they'll selectively approach the familiar one over the novel one. Okay? So with that logic, you can now repeat all of the object perception studies that I just told you about. So you take a chick, for example, and imprint it on day one of its life to a fully visible triangle. Okay? And then on day two, put it in a room that's got a center occluded triangle at one side and a triangle with a hole in the middle on the other side, same visible surfaces. Notice this is a beautiful controlled rearing study. This chick has never seen an occluded object before. It opened its eyes for the first time yesterday and all it saw was one fully visible object. Absolutely no experience with occlusion. And the question is, will it do what four-month-old human infants, of course, who do have experience of occlusion, will it do what they do and take this creature to be more like mom than that one? And the answer is robustly yes, they will gravitate towards this creature. And that study and a whole bunch of other variants on it, testing out different alternative interpretations, controlling for different perceptual variables and so forth, supports the conclusion that this basic mechanism for perceiving the unity of an object that's partly occluded is present and functional at 2 days of age in chicks. I think making it less exciting and less mysterious that we find it at 4 months of age in infants. Yeah?
Does the triangle move or is it just fixed?
Good. In the initial day of imprinting, it's on a string, so it kind of dangles and it jiggles. And the chick can move around it. It's in the middle of the cage, so that it's never hidden behind anything else. It's the only object that's there. For the test, I believe they're stationary. I think it's important that there be motion during the imprinting experience, but once they've had that experience, I think they then generalize to stationary arrays, and these were stationary. There have been other studies that have used the situation that we tested where there's a bar that moves behind an occluder, and in that case, during the test, you had, I think, they did it in reverse of this study. They imprinted to the bar that moved behind the occluder. It was actually more similar to the studies we ran on babies. And then for the test, they took the occluder away and they have a complete bar at one side and a bar with a gap in the, two bars with a gap in the middle on the other side. And they both moved the same way the thing had moved initially, which was really exactly the way we ran the studies with babies. And that also gave positive results. You know, they gravitated toward the single bar over the one with the gap in it at a day of age. The most humbling finding, though, I think comes from one that Lucia Regalin and her colleagues did using a method that I'm curious to know what you guys think about this. I see it as implementing in a one-day-old chick an experiment of Piaget's that human infants don't solve until they're about 12 to 18 months of age. It's an A, not B. No, it's a visible displacement task, 8 to 12 months of age, okay? What happens in this task is the chick is in a little it's been imprinted to the green ping pong ball, okay? So that's mom. Green ping pong ball is mom. And now the chick is put in a little plexiglass container, and it sees mom on the end of a string moved behind a screen. And there's two screens there, okay? Then there's a delay, and, you know, got to keep an active representation, strain memory a little bit here. There's a delay, and then the chick is released the plexiglass from the plexiglass box and goes straight to the correct side, showing that it can retrieve mom from behind an occluder at 1 day of age, okay? But then they went on, they read later chapters in Piaget's Construction of Reality. They went on to test what happens if we let the chick retrieve mom 3 times on this side and then switch her to the other side with a nice delay, right? Succeed on the very first time, goes to the chick goes to the correct side. So, interesting challenge. Can you think of mechanisms for, you know, I mean, how would you know whether the same mechanism is at work here, that's at work in a 12-month-old infant and is giving infants trouble before that? One thing, and this may relate to the issue of domain specificity, nobody has gotten this effect to work for any object other than an imprinted one. So Regalin's group tried, for example, to see, suppose we make the chicks hungry and it's food that we hide in one or another place. You don't see these effects, okay? You only see them if it's mom. Nevertheless, I think the fact that you can see them at all says that there's some kind of core system for representing objects over occlusion and keeping track of their motions, at least under some limited set of conditions, which can arise very, very early in vertebrates' development and is certainly not unique to humans. Yeah?
Quick question on that experiment. I'm assuming that they repeated the A not B, where they take the mom behind the first screen.
Yeah. Great question. Great question. You know, I think they have because I talked to Regalin and her group about this, about just that, and she said that they were in the process of doing it. I haven't seen a report of it. So I don't actually know. That would be a visible displacement task, and of course it would also be fun to do invisible displacement tasks, right? I don't know whether they've tried and failed or whether they never actually got around to doing those experiments. It would be extremely interesting to do that. Yeah.
Can one think about this in chicks neurologically? And I raise the question because one thing we've alluded to in class is that the Del Diamond stuff, which, you know, basically claims you have A not B,
right.
The prefrontal lobes are
right.
Beginning to function.
Right.
That couldn't be the case here. So the question is,
right.
What's going on?
Yeah, I know. It's a wonderful question. Do you only need frontal lobes to hold actively in mind information that's not privileged for you, that's otherwise arbitrary, that you're going to be forgetting if you don't do that? If that's right, then the chicks don't have frontal lobes, and that may be why they fail when it's food or something else arbitrary, that they're only succeeding for mom when it really, really matters. And maybe, you know, prefrontal cortex takes over when it doesn't really, really matter to the point where you've got a neural architecture that's directly supporting this capacity. But I don't know. I mean, it's a great question. And, of course, one great way to try to ask, are we dealing by the issue that Mark Hauser will probably be talking about on December 9th, one of the issues he'll talk about that comes up in spades here is, are we dealing here with a homology or an analogy? Okay, are we seeing in the chick the very same mechanism that we use for holding on to information? Or are we seeing a different mechanism that just happens to give the same result because chicks find themselves in an ecology that has some similar demands to our ecology? So they've evolved a different way of solving the problem. These data in themselves don't answer that question. So one strategy that could be very useful would be to look at the neural mechanisms, both in humans and in chicks, and see, can we see common neural signatures of performance here and in the humans? Another way would be to look at delay and see, do we see the same kinds of qualitative effects of delay in the chicks that we see in humans? Lots of hands. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, have there been any experiments with the human babies where the mother is the object?
Yes, there have. There's an old literature on that. My recollection of it is that kids don't do much better with mom than they do with other creatures. Is that right?
I did one of those studies.
Yeah.
They're a little bit better with mom. And a little bit better with a novel object.
Yeah.
as opposed to a familiar oxygen supply.
Yeah.
But very little.
And Maria Ledrusty has done some work recently where she argued that kids were much, much better. But I think that her studies are actually subject to a criticism that Piaget made kind of in advance of that whole, that there could be other mechanisms leading kids to look better than they actually are when mom is present. The nice thing about the imprinting is because you don't need to use a real chick, because you can imprint to a ball, you can really control for a lot of alternative strategies and make sure that they're not, you know, solving the problem in some other way. There was another question over here. Yeah. Oh, okay, fine. I haven't gotten much to number yet, have I? Let me move to what I think is another manifestation of the same system of representation, but in a context that looks much more numerical than the context I've been giving you so far. Okay, this is a diagram of a part of the famous experiment by Karen Wynn, which she published under the title Addition and Subtraction in Human Infants about 10 years ago. She did a variety of studies that basically had the format that you see here, where kids were presented with a single object on a puppet stage, screen came down and covered that object, then a second object was introduced from the side of the stage and put behind the screen, and then the infants were asked, in effect, how many Mickey Mouses are there behind the screen? And the way they were asked that question is the screen was lowered to reveal different numbers, one Mickey Mouse, two Mickey Mouses, three, and the infant's looking time was recorded, and on the assumption that if you presented the correct number, that wouldn't be such a big deal. If you presented the wrong number and the baby knew it was the wrong number, they'd do a double take, they'd look longer, and you'd get longer looking. And the report was that in this 1 plus 1 equals 1 versus 2 study, the babies looked longer at 1. When she did 1 plus 1 equals 2 versus 3, they looked longer at 3. When she did 2 minus 1, so initially there's two dolls on the stage, and then the screen is covered, and then a hand comes in and removes one of the two dolls. When she did 2 minus 1 equals 1 versus 2, they look longer at 2 than at 1, okay? So, yeah.
I mean, how old were the children?
5 months.
Okay. Okay, at 12 months, aren't they going to see it as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? Because, I mean, before 12 months, they're seeing these all, they're seeing this as one object.
Before 12 months, they're getting spatiotemporal information that there's two objects here. I wonder if I diagrammed this well enough. So, yeah, there's steps left out here. I could probably do it better with the pantomime. There's a single object on the scene, and then the screen comes up. So the system for tracking objects I've told you about so far should lead to the idea that the babies will hold on to a representation of that object behind the screen. Now something comes in from the side of the stage. Okay, by the constraint of continuity, that things have to move on connected paths, the thing that comes in from the side can't be the same as the thing that's behind the screen because they never saw anything leave from there. So that's a little like the situation I told you about where you've got two screens and something moves behind the first one, then they see nothing in the middle and something comes out from behind the other and they infer two. So when the thing comes in from the side, it's a distinct object. And then it goes behind the screen and the question is how many objects are back there? And the kid represents two distinct objects. Yeah.
I believe in this study, one of the big questions, or maybe it was DeHaene who did afterwards, uh-huh, looking at this, was the representation of zero. And
right.
Whether or not, and I think the argument is that at this point they don't have a concept of zero.
Yeah.
So in reading these, I don't recall seeing experiments testing 3 minus 3.
Right.
2 minus
right.
3.
I don't think they've done that. But hold that thought. Because I'm going to argue they don't have a concept of one or two. I'm going to argue that what they represent is thing and thing, okay? Not set with cardinal value two, okay? But I completely agree. There's, you know, no evidence, limited evidence for a concept of zero. I don't think we even have to grant kids a concept of one or two. What I do think we have to grant them is a capacity for representing objects and tracking them through time and over occlusion. Okay. Anyway, that's just an initial finding. So, and here's what I just said. Babies are representing occluded objects. They're keeping track of the distinctness of two objects that couldn't be a single unit that moved on a connected path because one was behind a screen and another appeared from the side. And they're representing the effects of adding or subtracting an object from the scene. We're going to get back to the question, does that mean they understand what addition and subtraction is? I don't mean to say that now. But they do represent the effects of putting something into the scene or taking something away. Now, this task has been used for a variety of different operations. As I just said, it shows the same signature limit that I talked about with the shoe and carry experiments. Remember the duck sitting on the truck or the duck and the truck that come out in succession behind the screen. Beautiful version of this study was done by Tony Simon and his collaborators, where they repeated the 1+1 experiment, but instead of having two identical looking Mickey Mouses, they had two different looking puppets, an Elmo puppet and an Ernie puppet. And then when the screen was raised, you could either present the right or wrong number, or you could present the right or wrong puppets. Okay? And what they found was they replicated when babies looked longer when the wrong number appeared, but they didn't look longer when the wrong puppets appeared, as if they're representing thing and thing behind the screen, but not Elmo and Ernie. I think that goes right along with the Shu Carey findings saying they're not representing duck and truck. Okay? Not taking account of these feature changes in tracking objects over time and over occlusion. The phenomenon is also robust over location changes. Now, I just was recently interviewed by the New York Times. I think there's going to be an article coming out, raising a whole controversy. Can we believe the findings of these preferential looking studies? Do babies really look longer when the wrong number of objects appears in Wynn's task? Once again, I'm going to try to sidestep this issue. Our main focus is going to be on what are the building blocks that kids use so that when they're 5 or 6 years old and start school for the first time, they can do symbolic, they can learn about symbolic number. And from the point of view of that question, I think it's important to underline that the results that Wynn got can be and have been replicated in detail with other methods that have nothing to do with preferential looking, provided that you go to old enough kids that the other methods apply. So Susan Carey's lab has been hard at work on this. They've used two different methods, one of which relies on manipulation, manual exploration as a measure, the other of which relies on locomotion as a measure. So the manual exploration one you can't do on a 5-month-old infant. You have to wait until a baby is old enough to reach into a box for an object, about 8 months. But once they're old enough to reach into a box for an object, you can now run Wynn's experiment using reaching as a method. How do you do that? You've got a box. You put an object into the box, one of the Mickey Mouses into the box. Then you take a second Mickey Mouse, put it into the box, and then you hand the box to the kids. Oh, you've surreptitiously removed one of the two objects, so there's only one in there. You hand the box to the kid. They retrieve the one object that's in there, and you take it away from them. And the question is, what do they do now? Okay? If they think there's only one object in the box, they shouldn't reach back in. If they think there are two objects, they should reach back in, searching for the second one. And if they have no determinate idea how many objects there are, you should see some indeterminate intermediate pattern. What they in fact find with this method, which just goes right along with the Wynn findings, is if it's the study that I just described, 1+1, kids reach in twice. If it's 2-1, they reach in once and don't go back a second time. And similarly for all the other variations. They, you know, for 2+1 is 3, and you make it, you take one out, so there's actually only two in there. They'll go in for a third. The findings of the manipulation task totally replicate the findings from the preferential looking test. So by the time kids are old enough to reach into boxes, I don't think there's any longer any question that they've got these object tracking abilities. The locomotor choice task shows the same basic thing. What you do here is you make the objects cookies or graham crackers. You've got two boxes. You put some number into one and a different number into the other. You move the cookies far enough apart from each other that the kid can't go to them all simultaneously, and you simply observe where do they go. And lo and behold, they go to the box that has the larger number of cookies. And that works with addition and with subtraction and all that. Yeah?
I know they've done that controlling for amount of cookies, like size.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how that corresponds with the study that you just talked about with changing the Mickey Mouses.
Yeah. Let's...
You can talk.
I don't want to punt. I want to discuss it. But I don't think I want to discuss it just yet. Let's hold it 1 minute, okay? Don't let me forget it, though. A question. Do they go here because there's more cookies? Three cookies is more than two? Or do they go here because there's more cookie stuff? Okay? We're going to have to come back to that. Okay. So what about the... Was that all I wanted to say about... Yeah, so it's a robust ability. It shows these limits. I think I've already... Oh, no, I haven't already said this. So if you look at these win-type situations with the, both the preferential-looking method, the reaching-in-the-box method, and the box-choice method, and ask what limits kids' success, first of all, they're limited to success when they're presented with objects. Solid, rigid, manipulable objects. The very same tasks that give success when kids are presented with objects give failure if kids are presented with non-solid substances. So Carrie's lab has done a whole series of studies using Wynn's 1 plus 1 equals 2 method, but instead of moving Mickey Mouse dolls behind a screen, they pour piles of sand behind the screen. The kids fail utterly in all those studies. And Wynn has shown they also fail if you take piles of blocks and make pyramids out of them. So that's one important limit. The second important limit is a set size limit. These studies, infants succeed at these studies when they're presented with up to three objects. They fail when they're presented with larger number of objects, larger numbers. So for example, in the Wynn study, the preferential looking version, babies will successfully add, in quotes, 1 plus 1 to yield 2 rather than 1, but they fail to add 5 plus 5 to yield 10 rather than 5, even though the ratio differences are the same. You put five blocks on a stage, cover them with a screen, take 5 more blocks, push them behind the screen, and then raise the screen, revealing either 5 or 10. They look equally in that case, all right, even though it's a 2-to-1 ratio difference. So there's a set size limit. And in this situation, if it were simply more graham cracker, then you might think if you had 5 over here and 10 over here, they would succeed, but they don't. They fail in that case. They only succeed with small numbers of objects, okay? We're not done talking about continuous quantity, but at least it's not summing over indefinitely large amounts of continuous quantity. There's actually a very nice control that they did here, because then you could worry, well, maybe if you put 5 things in here and 10 things in here, you're really trying the child's patience, right? They've got to watch for a long time, and maybe it just gets to be too boring. So they did the following control. They contrasted a case where children succeed, let's see, with a case where they fail. Let me give you the one where they fail first. It turns out kids will fail if you have 3 in one side and 6 in the other. That's too many. They fail, okay? They contrasted that with the case where you have 1 in one side and 2 in the other, but the 1 is put in and taken out 3 times, and the 2 are each put in and taken out 3 times. So you've got 6, you know, 3 times that a hand is entering here and 6 times that a hand is entering here in both cases. But in one version of the study, you just have to track a single object over here and 2 of them over here. In the other version, you've got to track 3 over here and 6 over here. They fail with 3 versus 6, and they succeed under those conditions with 1 versus 2. Okay. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you use, for example, goldfish instead of cookies, it's more like sand.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think they've done that experiment. They would predict that kids would fail. But they ought to push this further, and I don't think they've done that study. Okay, so they fail with large numbers. Now, everything that I've said about human infants, monkeys can do, except they do it better. Okay, so Mark Hauser has and Susan have done a series of studies. They've done 2 versions of them, actually. One series of studies on semi-free-ranging rhesus monkeys living on this beautiful Puerto Rican island that Mark will show you pictures of probably when he comes to talk here. They've also done them on laboratory-raised cotton-top tamarins. And in both cases, you see qualitatively the same 3 methods. have been used with the monkeys as with human infants. Qualitatively, the same pattern of performance. The only real difference is that whereas human infants show a set size limit of 3 objects, the monkeys can get up to 4 objects. So they're a little better. They can deal with one more object than these are adult monkeys than the human infants can. But qualitatively, the performance looks the same for the monkeys as for the human infants. 2 apple pieces in one box, 1 apple piece in the other box is just fine. But 8 in one and 4 in the other, forget it. They can't do it, okay? All right. What about adults? Does this system continue to work in us as adults? Well, there's a literature that goes back over 100 years arguing that there's a special process of numerical representation and estimation that kicks in for us as adults when we're dealing with very small numbers of entities, generally called subitizing. Okay? And the idea is that this is a parallel automatic process. When you're presented with an array that has 7 dots in it and you're told, tell me how many dots are in this array as quickly as you can, you have to go along and serially count the dots to get to the answer. But the argument goes, if you're presented with an array that has just 3 dots in it or just 4 dots in it, you don't need to count. The number just leaps out at you. And the idea is that this is this process for keeping track of small numbers of objects up to a limit of about 4. And Zenon Politian has suggested that the mechanism that underlies subitizing is a mechanism for tracking objects. And his student, Brian Scholl, looked at that claim in connection to the literature on object representation in infants. And he asked, are we dealing with the same mechanism here in infants and in adults? Okay. Now, this is logically related to the question we raised a few minutes ago in comparing human infants to other animals and asking, is this a case of a homology, same mechanism at work in different species, or just analogy, different mechanisms giving the same result? Okay, here's a developmental version of that question. Is there a homology here? Is there a continuity over development? So the very same mechanism that babies use to track objects in Karen Wynn's 1+1 tasks, is that the same mechanism that adults use to immediately tell you there's 4 things here? Okay. Now, Politian had suggested that it might be because he looked at conditions that under which adults fail to do this, and they seemed similar to conditions under which babies fail to represent objects. So we know babies have trouble with when one object is embedded within another, and it turned out that adults in a subitizing experiment have to do something pretty close to counting these circles to tell you that there's 4 here. 4 leaps out at you over here. It doesn't really leap out so much over here. But Brian Scholl tried to push this issue much further by using a task that Politian had developed called the multiple object tracking task. And if I were better with PowerPoint, I'd actually have an animated version and put you all through this task, but I'm not, so I just have to talk you through it. Here's how the task goes. This is, by the way, so what we're trying to do here is we're trying to find a way to do studies on adults that will elicit a mechanism that we think we found in infants. I say we, I really mean Brian Scholl. He's the one who did these studies. So what's the task? Well, in this task, you're shown on a computer screen a large array of dots, too many to keep track of. In this example, I guess there were 8 of them, okay? And then a subset, initially they're stationary, and a subset of those dots flash. And that's your cue. These are your dots. These are the ones you have to keep track of. So you have to keep track of the one on the upper left and, you know, the other 3 that are flashing. You can forget the other dots in the array. Just keep track of those, okay? Then the flashing stops so that all the dots look identical again. And all the dots start to move. Each dot moves continuously on a kind of random walk through the scene. And while these dots are moving around, you've got to keep your attention on the 4 that are your dots, okay, that you need to keep track of your 4 dots. And then, in order to see whether you've done a good job of this, whether you've actually managed to keep track of them, after they move for a while, the array stops, and one of the 8 items in the array will flash, and you have to say, was it one of your 4 dots that flashed, okay? So is the task clear? This task turns out to be trivially easy if there's just 1 dot that you have to keep track of. It's also very easy if there's 2 dots. It's not too bad if there are 3. It starts getting hard when there are 4, and your ability to do this falls apart altogether if you've got to keep track of 5. okay? So it looks like there's a set size limit between 3 and 4 as to how many dots you can keep track of. And actually, if people are interested in this, go to Yale University and look for Brian Scholl, S-C-H-O-L-L, and click on his website, and you'll see demonstrations of this. And it's really neat to see. You don't gracefully degrade. You go from being able to keep track of everything to just totally falling apart and having no clue what, you know, which of these dots you're supposed to be following and which you aren't. Okay, so this is a task that seems to show a set size limit related to what we see in infants. Well, is that because the same mechanism is at work? Not really convincing yet, but there's more questions we can ask. I've told you a bunch of things about the conditions under which babies succeed at tracking objects over time and the conditions under which they fail. For example, that babies succeed in tracking objects over occlusion. But we've known for a long time, it was actually first suggested by T.G.R. Bauer and later shown in better experiments by other people, that although babies can keep track of objects that move behind occluders, if an object just blips out of existence in one location and blips back into existence in another location, babies don't track it as a continuously existing object. Okay? So that led Brian Scholl to ask, what about in the multiple object tracking task? Suppose we have people track 3 or 4 dots that are moving around, but that aren't continuously visible. And suppose they either go out of sight by going behind an occluder, or they go out of sight by blipping out of existence, like here. They just kind of disappear into a point. Well, it turned out people are just fine at tracking in this task behind an over-occlusion, and they fall apart completely if they have to track things that just vanish and, you know, go out of existence and then come back into existence, even if the two conditions are set up as Scholl did. So you see exactly the same path of visible motion, exactly the same duration of invisibility and so forth. Okay? So that was the first hint that there may be something similar in this system in adults to what we see in infants. But here's even more dramatic evidence. We saw that infants, when they're tracking objects in and out of view, do not keep track of properties of the objects like their colors, their shapes, their sizes, and so forth. And that led Scholl to ask, will adults' multiple object tracking be affected by these things? Will adults track better if they see something like the event on top, where a blue circle moves continuously in and out of view, than when they see something like the event at the bottom, where a red circle moves out of view and a yellow square comes into view? And the surprising finding was these feature changes had no effect on adults whatsoever. Adults were just as good at tracking when features changed as when features stayed the same. And when Scholl asked people afterwards in the feature change condition, tell me something about these objects, what went on in this scene, people were remarkably insensitive to the feature changes. They often couldn't say what the colors and shapes of these forms were, but they knew which ones were theirs that they had to be tracking over time. So that's a second similarity between the infant object tracking and adult object tracking. But here's my favorite similarity, the third one. I told you that babies use spatiotemporal information to track objects, but that the system for tracking objects is domain specific. It works for objects, but it doesn't work for collections of objects. I don't think I told you this, but there's also evidence it doesn't work for parts of objects. So in order to be tracked by an infant, you've got to be a total, connected, bounded unit, okay? A part of a unit doesn't count as a good object. So Scholl asked, what would happen if we take our 8 discs in the original multiple object tracking task, run the task just like before, but just add something to the scene? And what he added to the scene were these white lines that took pairs of discs and connected them. So instead of each disc appearing to be a separate object, each disc appeared to be the end of, you know, one part of a connected object, a barbell. Okay? So the task now, follow those 4 ends of barbells and ignore the rest of the display. And the amazing finding is adults are completely unable to do this task. Okay? And again, that's one to try on his website. It's so interesting. You really try to keep your attention on those 4 ends of objects, and what happens is your attention just spreads from those ends to the rest of the objects, and you can't, and you get lost. So it looks like yet another signature of the infant's object tracking is present in the adults. Okay, I've spent way too much time on this first system, so let me just quickly summarize it. It looks like there's a system for representing objects, which is domain-specific. It's task-specific. It's used for object tracking, but not for categorizing objects or other kinds of tasks. It's relatively encapsulated. It works off spatiotemporal information, but not off information about the features of things. The same system seems to be present in human infants, in non-human primates, and in human adults. And the evidence for that is not only that all these creatures have abilities to track objects, but that their object tracking all shows the same signature limits, the set size signature, the insensitivity to property information, the domain specificity, it's got to be an object, and so forth. Okay? Now, this system is providing infants with a kind of numerical information, information about numerically distinct individuals, and information about the effects of adding or removing one individual from a scene. But it's not, I suggest, a full-blown representation of number. One way to see that is to turn to a second system of that provides infants also with some numerical information, because we'll see that it's providing some information that the first system is not providing, and it's also failing to provide some information that the first system is providing. So we're now shifting to the second core system, which Stanislaus Dehaene, who I guess some of you have read anyway, calls number sense, a system for representing large approximate numerical magnitudes. Now, the first evidence for this system came from experiments on laboratory-trained animals, rats and pigeons and other animals who've been trained in tasks where the crucial feature of the task is that they have to respond to a given number. So one kind of task, I think this is the one that's diagrammed here, a rat is trained that it has to press a lever a given number of times, after which, if it goes to another lever and presses it, it'll get a pellet of food. Okay, and on different sessions, you can vary the number of the rules. You can vary the number of times that the rat has to press on the first lever before switching to the second lever. And when you do this, you find a number of things. The investigators who did this found a number of things. One thing you find is that animals can learn to respond to number. Okay, they also find that the response is truly to number and not to other variables that are potentially correlated with number. Okay, for example, you can make the lever stickier, so the rat has to make more effort to press it, and ask, has the rat learned the rule press 16 times, or has the rat learned the rule press until I feel tired to such and such an extent? Well, if it were the second, then by making it harder to press, he'd press fewer times. But in fact, it's number that controls the response. And similar kinds of manipulations will show it's not duration, it's not amount of time, well, you know, the various continuous variables that have been controlled for, showing that the animals truly do respond to number. Second main finding, though, is that they're not responding to number exactly. They respond to number approximately. So if the rule is push 16 times, they'll push about 16 times. Okay? Actually, in this particular study, there's a penalty for pushing too few times, no penalty for pushing too many times. So whatever the rule was, they'll tend to go over a little bit. So when the rule is press 16 times, they're pressing on average 18 times. You can shift that optimum point downward if you change the penalty structure. If there was a penalty for pushing too many times, you would then see it push downward. But what you would see in all of these studies, what you do see in all of these studies, is there's a spread of performance around the modal number. And if you ask how broad is the spread, it depends on how high the number is. So accuracy is higher for lower numbers than it is for higher numbers. And in fact, the relation between numerical magnitude and accuracy is so lawful. There's a name for the law that it follows. It follows Weber's law. Basically, the variability in the response is proportional to the numerical magnitude. So if a number is twice as high, the variability will be twice as great. Okay? All right. So that's from animal studies. You can do this stuff with infants, and you can also do it with adults. We started out by using dot arrays and doing experiments sort of like this. I'm going to make this go fast so that you can't count them and you'll get a sense of what it's like to be a baby in our studies. You might see arrays like that, followed by that, and that, and that. And the question is, has number changed from the last array to the others? The answer is yes. What we've done in these studies, because we wanted to focus on infants' responses to number and not other continuous variables, is present succession of arrays that differ in numerosity. I'm sorry, a succession of arrays that have the same numerosity but that differ in all of the other continuous variables. So some of them, you know, if we're taking a baby and presenting them always with arrays of 8 dots, which is what I was showing you, sometimes it'll be 8 small dots, sometimes 8 big dots, sometimes 8 medium-sized dots. They'll be varying in all of those properties. That would be for half the babies. For the other half of the babies, they'd see arrays of 16 dots. And the dots would, on average, be half the size as the 8-dot arrays. And then for the test, we test with 8 versus 16 dots and now make everything the same size so that I'm going too fast here, probably. But the basic idea is that you want to equate for all of the variables that could co-vary with number. We equate for some of them during the initial familiarization period and for the others during the test. And the idea is that if babies are responding to continuous variables, they would then look equally at the two test displays because those variables have all been equated. But if they're responding to number, they should look longer. When, if they've seen a succession of arrays of 8, you now present 16, they should look longer. And that's, in fact, what Fei-Shu found when she ran this study. Babies, I think this was, yes, 8 versus 16, babies who were familiarized with arrays of 8 looked longer at 16, and those who were familiarized with 16 looked longer at 8, showing that they were able to discriminate on the basis of numerosity. But she also showed that babies' discriminations were highly imprecise. Although they succeeded with 8 versus 16, they failed with 8 versus 12. Okay, those are pretty different, but these are 6-month-old infants, and 6-month-olds failed. So what else were babies able to do? Well, having shown success with 8 versus 16, Shu went on to look at larger numbers and smaller numbers. She found that they succeed whenever the two numerosities are in a 2-to-1 ratio and the numbers are larger than 4. So they succeed at 16 versus 32 dots or 4 versus 8 dots. She also found that they fail when numbers are in a 2-to-3 ratio. I showed you a failure with 8 versus 12. They also fail with 16 versus 24. And I don't have it on here, but she's tested 4 versus 6. They fail with that as well. So it looks like, as for the animals, it's the ratio, differences that are controlling, determining infants' performance. Babies can represent large numbers just like they can represent smaller numbers, but there's more variability around the larger numbers, so you need a bigger numerical difference in order to see discrimination. The other thing that Shu found that really puzzled us at first, and it's going to get us back to this question about responding to continuous variables. She repeated these studies using these dot arrays, like the ones like that, except instead of presenting a whole lot of dots, she presented just one or just two, looking at discrimination of one from two, or just two and just four. Okay, she presented in the small number range, the range at which babies were succeeding in the WIN task. But notice that this is a very different task. In the WIN task, babies are tracking individuals through time and over occlusion. There's only one object in the scene, or there's only two objects in the scene. What they're doing here is they're seeing different individuals on every trial, two small dots on the first trial, two huge dots on the second trial, and so forth. And what they're being asked is there something the same over the succession of trials? Okay, are we always presenting two? Now, the infants are failing to answer that question. Okay, they're failing to detect what's the same between two small dots, two medium-sized dots, two large dots. And in fact, further studies suggest that what they do when you present two small dots, to the extent that they detect anything about the array, it's the total surface area that they're responding to, not the number. So it looks like when you present babies with an array of 8 or an array of 16, they will represent a set with an approximate cardinal value, because they can tell you later, 16 is a different number from 8. Okay, but when you present an array of 1 or an array of 2, the baby's attention may be focused on the objects and on tracking those objects through time. They don't seem to perceive those objects as forming a set with a cardinal value. So that's why I think, in answer to the question you asked before, they don't have a concept 0. In some sense, they don't have a concept 1 or 2. They have a capacity for tracking 1 or 2 objects, but not for seeing them as forming a set with the same cardinal value as the set formed by two other objects. Okay. Yeah.
So then a follow-up on WIN study. Has there been a case where you say you take two Mickey Mouse dolls at the same time and put them behind, and you remove one surreptitiously, or do the additions, but instead of like putting in one,
yeah,
you put in two together, so there's a, it seems like that could possibly...
It doesn't work when you do it that way. It still doesn't work. So Wynn has done it where she puts two in at once.
That's really the question, not really.
Yeah.
I have an answer for it. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
If that
right. No, it doesn't work that way. What seems to work is when babies are able to track individual objects and you've got few enough of them that you don't hit the limit on the number of objects that they can track in parallel. Yeah?
Has she done it with total circumstances? So you put two behind
yes.
and then remove the screen and there's one big one?
Yes. Lisa Feigenson has done that study and babies respond to surface area, not number, under that condition. Wynn has argued, though, and I think she's probably right, that when you have put two little ones behind a screen and then you reveal one big one, if the kids have really been tracking the objects, then this should look really weird, right? Both of them are gone and something else is there in its place. So the fact that kids don't succeed in tracking number in that situation may actually be because it's just a weird situation for them. But these situations here that we use are not weird. It's not weird to see successions of different arrays of different individuals. And the babies show us that they don't think that they're weird because when we present large numbers, they respond just fine. It just looks like with the smallest numbers, they're failing to do so. Right. So they're representing continuous quantities for the very small numbers. Liz Brannan has recently done studies asking, can babies represent continuous quantities for large numbers? And the answer seems to be no. That's kind of a neat result. So if you, in the studies that I've been describing on discriminating 8 from 16, the baby always sees 8. But item sizes are changing, so the amount of surface area that's covered is changing. And they respond to constant number over changes in surface area. Brannan has done the symmetrical opposite experiment, where number is always changing, but surface area is always the same. So on one trial, the baby may see 16 small things, and on the next trial, 4 large things, and you know, such that the total amount of surface area covered is the same. And the question is, can babies detect that relationship? When numbers are small, like 1 versus 2, the answer is yes, indeed, they do detect that. That's what they respond to. With large numbers, they seem not to. So this looks like a double dissociation. It looks like a very different representation is being formed when babies are getting large arrays of elements versus when they're getting very small numbers of objects. Yeah.
You should explain double dissociation, which you also had in the paper.
Oh, I should explain that.
Yes.
Oof. Okay, so the idea is, for us as adults, if we think about our concept of 2, and our concept of 7, seems very plausible to think these different concepts are handled by the same mechanism. We have a mechanism for representing natural numbers. We can arrive at a representation by counting. We know that both the number 2 and the number 7 can be added, subtracted, multiplied, divided, that they participate in the same system of knowledge. So we would expect, if a single system of knowledge is at work, then whatever limits to our ability to use that system appear when we have to deal with the number 7 should be the same when we have to deal with the number 2, if they're in the same system. Okay? But sometimes different concepts are handled by different systems, and a very good source of information for that can come from behavioral experiments that yield double dissociations. A double dissociation being a case where there's a manipulation you can do that impairs your ability to operate on one of the concepts while preserving your ability to operate on the other one, and another manipulation you can do that has the reverse effect. So it's not just that one of the concepts is harder than the other, it's that they're qualitatively different. Okay? So here we have a situation where if you vary surface area, kids can still extract numerosity information from large number arrays, but they no longer can from small number arrays, okay? Suggesting that that's a situation in which they're doing better with the large numbers than with the small numbers. But if you now ask them what was the surface area, you get the reverse pattern. They do better with the small numbers than with the large numbers, suggesting it's not just that one of these is easier than the other, but rather that there's qualitatively different mechanisms at work in forming the representations of the two. Okay. I want to go faster now because I haven't gotten to 5-year-olds yet. We've also done these studies with sounds, following exactly the same logic, but instead of arrays of dots, you have sequences of sounds, and you control for the amount of sound, the duration of the sequence, the rate at which sounds are coming, and ask whether babies who are familiarized with four sounds, you can't use looking time with sounds. We use a very closely related measure that's been used a lot in the speech perception literature, orienting the head in the direction of a speaker. If you bore babies to tears, well, hopefully not quite to tears, with four sounds, they should orient longer when you now present eight, and vice versa if you've bored them with eight sounds. And that's the finding. You get longer orienting to the new number than to the old number. And if you ask, how good are babies at doing this? The answer is, their performance is identical to their performance with dot arrays. So at 6 months, they succeed with arrays in a 2-to-1 ratio, like 4 versus 8 and 8 versus 16. And they fail in a 3-to-2 ratio, so 4 versus 6 or 8 versus 12. They fail with very small numbers, just like they do with small numbers of dots. And we also found there's a change between 6 and 9 months. As babies get older, their numerical discrimination gets more precise, just like other kinds of perceptual discriminations do. Well, on the principle that anything a baby can do, a monkey can do better, Mark Hauser came along and repeated these sound discrimination studies with his cotton-top tamarins. They're actually not better than a 9-month-old infant. Their performance is very similar to the performance of 9-month-old human infants. They're better than a 6-month-old infant, and they're able to discriminate things in a 3-to-2 ratio. I think this is the first evidence for number discrimination in the large number range in an untrained animal. So there's been a big debate about the early studies I showed you, like the bar press one, asking, isn't representing number just a last resort for animals? And if you train them for a year and they learn they're not going to get fed unless they press this bar 16 times, you finally force them to represent number, but they won't do it spontaneously. I think these data suggest they do it spontaneously, because it's just the spontaneous head-turning, orienting procedure that we use with infants. It doesn't involve any training. Yeah.
I'm curious about, you know, the game where it's a circle and you have to repeat the order of the sound, and
yeah,
you get a visual cue and you get an auditory cue.
Uh-huh.
So that changes the number of representations the child can pull in the head. You know, because you have the auditory,
mm-hmm,
the sound that you, mm-hmm, have, and you have the visual sound.
Yeah.
But if you're combining them.
Oh, we really want to combine them. We haven't done that yet. We haven't done that yet. There's lots of interesting questions there. The first one I'd like to ask is, will babies transfer from one modality to another? Is their representation of number abstract enough that they can represent that an array of eight dots has about the same number of elements as a sequence of eight sounds? We don't know the answer to that question yet. But that'll be interesting, and it'll also be interesting to see how these modalities relate to each other. Well, here's that question for adults. Remember, I showed you the evidence from Scholl and Polishin that the system for representing, for tracking small numbers of objects continues to exist in adults. I think we have reason to think that the system for representing large approximate numerical magnitudes does as well. This is from research by Hilary Barth. She's done the intermodal studies, where basically she presents people with two arrays of sounds or two arrays of dots, or an array of sounds and an array of dots. And she's done a bunch of different experiments. In some experiments, she just asks, do they have the same number or a different number? In other experiments, she asks, which is more numerous? She always presents different numbers and asks, are there more dots or are there more tones? Okay? And both those studies give results that this is actually the comparison task, not the number matching task. She can compare how accurately subjects can make this comparative numerical judgment for entirely auditory sequences, entirely visual arrays, or when they're comparing one visual array to one auditory sequence. And it turns out people are almost as good at making the cross-modal comparison as they are at making a unimodal dots-to-dots or tones-to-tones comparison. Well, I'm bringing up Hilary's work because she was able to extend this work beyond anything we'd ever asked of an infant or a young child. She took her subjects, who were all Harvard and MIT undergraduates, and asked, can people do non-symbolic arithmetic? And I want to take you through this because it was the motivation for the last developmental studies I want to tell you about. Here's how a non-symbolic arithmetic task might work for Hilary. You're a subject in one of her studies. First, you see one array of dots. Then you see a second array of dots, and you're told mentally to sum the two arrays, okay, to think about the sum. Then you see a third array, and you have to ask, is the third array more or less numerous than the sum that you're holding in your head? Okay? You can do that with addition, as I just took you through here. You can also do it with subtraction. You can present a single array with lots of dots, a second array with fewer, mentally subtract the second from the first and think about the difference between them. You can do it with multiplication, and you can do it with division. Okay? That's, so you can look at all the different non-symbolic arithmetic operations just using dot arrays. Now, you can also look at non-symbolic operations not using dot arrays, purely dot arrays, which maybe we could use some purely visual mechanism to combine. You can do this across modalities. Here's another example of a task that Hillary ran. Present a sequence of tones, then an array of dots. And now you have to think about the sum of the number of tones and the number of dots. And you have to ask, is that sum larger or smaller than a test array, which would either be another sequence of tones or another array of dots? So you can do addition, subtraction, multiplication, or division. You can do within a modality or cross-modality. Not all the combinations have been done. This is new work. Let me show you where we are. Okay. First of all, this is just addition, and it's comparing unimodal addition to cross-modal addition, and it's comparing both of those to simple comparison. So simple, I'll come back to this. Simple comparison would be simple visual comparison. Instead of having two arrays here, you just have a single array, and the number of dots on it is, in fact, the sum of the two on this array. So in this study, on half the trials, you'd get addition, and on the other half, you just have comparison using the very same numerical values, okay? Similarly here, you do a cross-modal comparison. You might just get, since the test is an array of tones, just an array of dots with the number of dots equal to the sum of this and this, okay? So here are the results. First of all, she varied the difference ratio so that people would be at about 75% correct on the simple within-modality comparison. And then the question is, relative to that, how do you do on cross-modal comparison? And you can see, almost as good. And how do you do on visual addition and cross-modal addition? And there was the big surprise. As you can see, visual and cross-modal addition are just as good as cross-modal comparison. And cross-modal addition is just as good as visual addition. Okay? People are remarkably good at doing this test. Although, by the way, when people are asked to be subjects in the study and they're described in advance what they have to do, they say, forget it. You know, I'm not going to be able to do that. This is going to be ridiculously hard. Yeah?
But this non-symbolic is literally true because you aren't giving 12 and 18 and so on. But are people doing this by converting it into numbers?
Good question. We don't think so. Hillary debriefs people afterwards, and they say that's not what they're doing. She's also done experiments where she asks people to do that. She says, for each of these arrays, estimate a symbolic numerosity and add those in your head. When you do that, you get very similar performance in terms of accuracy, but way longer reaction times. So people are saying that they're not doing that. However, it's still possible, either, one, that people are doing this without being 100% aware of it, or, two, that the reason people are able to do these non-symbolic tasks is because they have a lifetime of practice doing symbolic addition. So in a minute, I'll give you one data point that I think addresses that. Okay, here's just a summary of how adults do on different operations. So the dark blue line is comparison across a wide range of different difference ratios. Remember, the Weber's law applies here. How good you are at a task depends on the ratio difference between the two arrays, the two numerosities that you're comparing. And then against comparison, you see addition is just about as good, almost as good as comparison. Subtraction is less good. Multiplication and division are less good. They're well above chance, but less good. And that raised the question, why are these other operations less good? Are they less good because there's more noise in the operations themselves? Or are they less good because there's more noise in the initial representation of the numbers? Now, why would that be? Well, think about the difference between an addition problem and a subtraction problem at a, I'm going to make it easy on myself, I'll take it 2-to-1 ratio, okay? So an addition problem at a 2-to-1 ratio would be something like, is 15 plus 20, is the sum of 15 and 20 more or less than 70, okay? What would a subtraction problem look like? It would have to be something like, is the difference of between 50 and 15 more or less than 70? Because in both cases, you end up with 35 that you're comparing to 70. But for the addition problem, you get to 35 by presenting two small arrays. For subtraction, if you want to get to 35, you've got to present at least one big array. And when arrays are bigger, the representation of that array is noisier. Well, Stanislaus Dehaene, fortunately, was a collaborator on all of this work. And he loves playing with numbers and math models and things like that. So he simply started with Weber's law, and he asked, how accurate would optimal addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division performance be if the operations themselves were error-free and the only error was in estimating how much there was in an initial array of 35 or 15 or 20, okay? And what you see here, the pluses are actual data, and the lines are the theoretical lines that you get from Weber's law predictions. And you see that people are almost as good as optimal. This is the amount of error. So higher numbers are bad, okay? Zero error would be the best. What you see is that people are almost as good as optimal performance would allow, given the noise in the representations. I want to get on to kid data, so let me just say, you know, I think that what this is suggesting is that adults are extremely good at all of these operations. We can perform them all, but that raises Howard's question. Are we only able to do this because we've learned how to do symbolic arithmetic, and so it has as a byproduct or side product that we can do symbolic arithmetic not only on symbols, but on non-symbolic arrays. So here's a way of addressing that question. Go to five-year-old children, and we've just started doing this. We don't have anything like a large array of data, but we have completed three experiments. So I'll take you through them. Okay, five-year-old kids sitting in front of a computer see an array of blue dots. And Kristen Lamont, who's doing these studies here in the psych department, says to kids, look at those blue dots. We've got some blue dots here. And then a screen comes on the computer screen, and it covers the blue dots. And she says, oh, there they go. The dots are behind the screen now. And here's some more blue dots, and they're going to go join the other blue dots behind the screen. And here's some red dots. Now tell me, are there more blue dots or are there more red dots? Okay? That's an addition version of the task. She also does a comparison version of the task, which I didn't bother to graph here, but basically the comparison version is you only see one array of red of blue dots, and it contains the sum of the two arrays in the corresponding addition task. And the question is, are there more blue dots or more red dots? Okay. Now, the first thing we worried about in doing these studies was right off the bat in the comparison condition. If you ask kids, are there more blue dots or more red dots, are they actually going to respond at age 5 on the basis of number? Or will they respond on the basis of other continuous variables, right? Maybe they'll interpret you as asking, is there more blue or more red on the screen? So we built the study so that for half the problems, the array that was numerically more also had more surface area. And for the other half the problems, the array that was numerically more had less surface area. So there were more blue dots, but they were tiny. There was actually more red on the screen when the red dots were there than there was blue on the screen when the blue dots were there. Turned out this had absolutely no effect on the kids. Absolutely none. Okay, they focused on number throughout, and they were just as accurate at telling you which array was numerically more when the continuous variables would have supported the opposite answer as when they supported the same answer. So the continuous variables don't seem to be an issue. How do kids do in this study? Well, the first study we ran, we had the two numerosities differing in a 3-to-5 ratio. They're extremely good at comparison and almost as good at addition, way above chance. We've done two more experiments on this, and we found, first of all, that kids are able to succeed above chance at a variety of different ratios. Their performance shows Weber's law signature, that is, their accuracy varies with variation in set size ratio and not with variation in absolute set size. So kids will do better if the two arrays differ in a 4-to-7 ratio than if they differ in a 4-to-5 ratio. But they'll do equally well if they've got large numbers in a 4-to-7 ratio versus smaller numbers in a 4-to-7 ratio. So the actual numerical size doesn't matter. I've already told you that the continuous variables don't matter. And finally, to directly get back to Howard's question, we assessed kids' understanding of symbolic addition at the very end of the study. We were worried, well, maybe some of these kids actually know some basic approximate symbolic addition facts. So we asked questions that actually used the same numerosities that we used in some of these problems. Like, suppose you've got 20 cookies in one jar and 12 cookies in another jar, and your friend's got 56 cookies in his jar. Who's got more, you or your friend? Okay, so it's purely symbolic numerosities, and you've got to do the same kind of addition. All right, kids were at chance on the symbolic versions of the problems. So we're pretty confident based on that they're not using symbolic knowledge of arithmetic to solve these non-symbolic problems. We think the core system for representing large approximate numerosities already is structured so as to support approximate non-symbolic addition, at least. And of course, we have to go on and ask, does it work across cross-modal versions? Does it work for other operations and so forth? We haven't gotten there yet. Okay, so let me summarize this. What I told you about the second system of core knowledge, that human infants, non-human primates, and human adults, and also human five-year-old children, represent large numerosities when continuous variables are controlled. These representations are approximate, and they show a signature ratio limit. Whereas the small number system showed a set size limit, this system shows a set size ratio limit. So as the ratio difference between the two numerosities gets smaller, discrimination gets harder. Now, the same ratio limit seems to be at work in the infant studies when they're given visual spatial arrays of dots, and when they're given sequences of sounds, okay? That just begins to suggest that maybe the limit on performance is not at the level of visual processing or auditory processing, but more central at the level of numerical processing. And further evidence for that comes from the studies of adults, showing that adults are able to do these operations and comparisons across modalities as well as within a single modality. And finally, these representations seem to support approximate non-symbolic arithmetic, at least addition for kids, and all the different operations it looks like for adults. Now, this system has two interesting limits that I've already described, so I'm just reminding you of them now. The first is that it fails to operate for very small set sizes. So kids can tell you that 8 is more than 16 and 4 is more than 8, but they don't seem to be able to tell you that 8 is less than 16 and 4 is less than 8. They don't seem to be able to tell you that 2 is less than 4 or 1 is less than 2. In the studies that we've done with infants. And that suggests that when you present them with small numbers of objects, those arrays engage their system for tracking individual objects and not a system for representing those objects as forming a set with a cardinal value. The other limit, which I already gave you in talking about the experiments with the graham crackers, is that the system for representing large approximate cardinal values doesn't seem to be able to cope with the operation plus one. The reason to think that is I've given you lots of evidence that babies can discriminate 4 from 8 when you present arrays of dots or sequences of sounds. But remember, if you go back to those locomotion box studies and you put 4 graham crackers in one box and 8 graham crackers in another box, and in both cases, you never show the 4 at once. You just go 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. They fail. Okay? So this system doesn't seem to work by successive additions of 1. Okay, so I've talked about two different systems for representing different aspects of numerical information, this object tracking system and the system of number sense. And I think all of these properties are in that chapter. I want to get on to how they get knit together. And the first thing to say there is that it looks like when kids start school, they're working with a notion of number that's really quite radically different from these two systems that seem to be at work in babies and in monkeys and in adults when we're prevented from using symbolic counting and other number representations. When kids get to school, they have to deal with number as one system, not two. They have to deal with number as a system that doesn't show either a set size limit or a set size ratio limit. They have to be able to deal with numbers larger than 4. And they have to be able to deal with the numerical difference between 8 and 7, not just 8 versus 4 or 8 versus 16. They have to be able to deal with precise numerical differences. More generally, I think that when kids, the notion of number that gets built on when kids are in school is a notion that each number picks out a set of numerically distinct individuals. But I think this notion, set of individuals, is not present in either of the child's core systems. They have the notion of numerically distinct individuals from the object tracking system. And I think they have the notion set from the system for representing large approximate numerical magnitudes. But if those are separate systems, isolated from one another, then there isn't any single unitary notion, set of individuals. And we have to ask, where does that notion come from? Well, first of all, there's no evidence, I think, that that notion exists in any non-human animal. You can challenge Mark Hauser on this when he's here, because, you know, he hates the conclusion that there's anything animals can't do. But I actually think that some of the most impressive cases where animals have been trained to deal with number show most vividly that animals are not dealing with number the way young kids do when they get to school. Basically, you can train a chimpanzee as Masuzawa, Tetsuro Masuzawa's trained eye, his chimpanzee who we worked with for 20 years, or you can train a parrot the way Irene Pepperberg has trained Alex, to respond to specific symbols for specific numbers. But what never seems to happen is that another animal gets the generalization that numbers can just go on indefinitely by adding one, and every new symbol, if you tell me it's part of the system of number knowledge, I'll know immediately what it means. You never seem to get that out of an animal. It was as hard for Matsuzawa to train I on a symbol for the number 9 after 20 years of training had taught her symbols for the numbers 1 through 8 as it was to teach her the original symbols. And that's obviously not the case for kids. Nobody has to train a kid what the word 9 means. Once they get up there, they've figured the whole system out. Well, how might kids figure this system out? There's been a lot of work, starting with work by Karen Fusen and Karen Wynn and others, and it's continuing at a rapid pace on the 11th floor of William James Hall. Both Susan Carey's lab and my lab have been involved in these studies, asking, what steps do kids go through in constructing an understanding of these natural number concepts? And we focused on, following Karen Wynn's example, we focused on kids' understanding of the words that participate in the counting routine. And basically, what we find is that kids go through at least 4 different stages in coming to understand these number words. In the first stage, they understand, the way you run these studies is you take kids who are 2 to 2.5 years of age at the beginning of the study, simply present them with a wide array of objects and ask them how many objects are in the scene, how many frogs are in the pond, okay? This is taken by kids as an invitation to count, and they'll go around and they'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so forth. And once they do this, you make note of all the words that they use, and now you query them on what those words mean to them. Okay? And the general findings are, first of all, when kids first start engaging in the counting routine, they don't have a clue what it is that they're doing. Okay? They just don't have the foggiest notion what they're doing. And Karen Wynn, for example, has been able to show this by taking a kid who will count to 6, count 6 frogs, okay, in the pond, and then she simply asks the child, can you give me 2 frogs? And most children will look at her as if, you know, she's just switched to some foreign language. They don't have any sense of what it is she's asking for. And then they'll grab a handful of objects to give to her. And the number that's in the handful is unrelated to the number that she asks for, except when the number's 1. So if she asks for 1 frog, she gets 1 frog. If she asks for 2 frogs or 4 frogs or 10 frogs or whatever numbers are in the child's counting routine, she gets a handful, okay? As if 1 means 1 and the other number words mean some, okay? A collection, more than 1. What I think may be going on at this stage is that the first thing kids do is they map the word 1 onto their system for tracking objects, and they know 1 picks out an individual. And the other number words get mapped onto the system for representing approximate numerical magnitudes. The other words pick out a bunch. And in fact, Susan Carey's got recent evidence that kids especially like to use the other number words and also the plural marker for sets larger than four, which would really go along with the idea that it's the large approximate system that's giving the first meaning of those words. Then, after about 9 months of engaging in counting, this is an eternity for a word learning child, right? They can learn most words in 9 seconds or so. But for after about 9 months, just after 3 years of age, kids figure out the meaning of the word two. And the reason I think it may take so long is what they have to do is realize that two is satisfied in case you've got a representation with two trackable objects. I don't want to use the word two in there. It's satisfied if you have a representation of an object and another numerically distinct object, and you have a representation of a set. Okay? It's got to be both. Two doesn't refer to this object. It doesn't refer to that object. It's a set composed of two objects. And that may be why it's so hard for kids to learn that meaning. Then, a few months later, they learn the meaning of the word three. And then comes the magic moment when kids seem to figure out that in progressing from two to three, you're adding one object and increasing set size, and then they're ready to generalize that principle to all of the other words in the counting routine and construct a notion of natural number. Yeah?
When I was reading about the study, I was wondering, how do you ever control for how much attention the kids are getting outside of your testing?
Right. Right. We don't. This is all purely descriptive work, right? We're not actually trying to move the learning process around. We're simply bringing kids into the lab and asking, what do you know about these number words? And we've done a whole bunch of other studies, which I think didn't make it into the chapter. Like, do they know that a number word like four, they grab a handful when you ask for four. Do they know that if you take one away, there's no longer four there? Answer, no, right? So what we've done is try to map that out. We haven't had any control over the experience that the child has. What we're actually just starting to begin to do now is training studies where we try to get some of that control. But the question is, can we take a child who only knows the meaning of the word one and teach them the meaning of the word two? Or teach them the meaning of the word six, for that matter. Okay? Can we do that? Can we? And if we're able to do that, what are the relevant experiences that we have to present to kids in order for that to happen? But to my knowledge, nobody has tried to do anything like that so far. All of these studies are descriptive. Okay. So here's the last piece of descriptive evidence. I actually really love this finding. I think that this is getting at the point at which kids move solidly behind anything that any non-human primate can do, any non-human animal can do. I just gave you this result. At age three, if you tell kids that there are, say, five fish in a pond, and you take one away, they don't know that that transformation is relevant, okay, as I just said. What happens, though, once a child is five, and you ask them the same question about numbers that they can't count to? So Jennifer Lipton just finished a study where she took five-year-olds, and she'd give them a counting task, like, this puppet's going to start counting, and when he stops, you take over. 57, 58. And you know, and then you see whether the kid can say 59, 60. If the kid succeeds at that, then you try higher numbers, you know, 93, 94, and can the child get all the way up, you know, to 100 and beyond? And for any given child, you'll find a point for a five-year-old where their ability to count breaks down, okay? Once you found a point where it breaks down, you can then bring out a jar full of marbles and say to the child, say it's a child who failed to get from 59 to 60, say to the child, there are 87 marbles in this jar, okay? And now, take one away. Are there 87? Okay? Even though this child doesn't have the skill of counting yet, they have the logic of the system, because they will tell you, no, there are not 87. I don't know what the name of the number is that there are, but I know it's not 87 anymore. Okay? Similarly, if you stir it, there are 87 marbles, stir them around. How many are there? 87. Okay? So they've mastered the logic of the system and gone beyond the specifics of what they're able to do. Okay, how do kids get to this point? Well, I've suggested, and I think this is in the paper, that what's happening is that kids are using the language of number words, other quantifiers, and the verbal counting routine to link together two core systems of representation, the two that I've been talking about all day today, the system for representing numerically distinct individuals and the systems for representing sets and their cardinal values. And that really, when we as adults think the thought seven, or when a child in school learns the fact that 7 plus 5 is 12, that they're building on a representation that, in fact, is distributed over these three systems. And they need all three of those systems in order to support that learning. Now, I think at the end of the article that you read, I talked about a bunch of studies that we and other people have done to try to test out this idea that when we represent natural numbers, we use these three systems in which to do it. We're just about out of time today, so maybe the thing to do is for me to just point to those and then throw this open to questions. If you want to ask me about them, you can ask me more about them then. So we've done things like bilingual, we've taken bilinguals and asked, if you teach people a new arithmetic fact in one of their two languages, will they immediately know that fact in their other language, or do they need to translate from the first language to the second? And the prediction is, if this picture of core knowledge and language linking core knowledge is right, then if the new facts you teach them have to do with approximate numerosities, they should be independent of language. If they have to do with exact numerosities, they should depend on language. And that's basically what we found. I won't go through the data. We found this in a whole bunch of different studies. I think this one didn't make it in there. These include not only studies where you teach people arithmetic facts, but where you just present sentences to them that have numerical information in them. So if you just say, and we've done this both with neuroimaging experiment and also in behavioral experiments, if you just say to people, two priests sang in the field and four farmers watched them from the hill, versus nine priests sang in the field and 11 farmers watched them in the hill, and now you probe, have they formed a representation of the scene that involves language or not? You can do that if they're bilingual by probing them in either the same language or the different language, their other language. And the finding is, if the numbers are like 2 and 4, very small numerical magnitudes, there's no effect of language. If they're approximate numbers like 10 and 20 or 50 and 100, no effect of language. You can easily switch from one to the other. But if it's large exact numbers like 9 versus 11, then there's a big cost to switching from one to the other. It takes a lot of time and also a decline in accuracy. And other findings, including activation of language parts of the brain when you're thinking about exact numbers as opposed to approximate, this left inferior frontal, and also the left angular gyrus, where it seems to be a place where quantity information gets mapped onto language. And that's it. I'll stop and let you ask me questions for the last minute and a half. Yeah?
Well, I'm interested in learning disabilities, and I don't know how this can be tested except for longitudinal studies, but if you attract infants and these different experiments do infants and then when they get to school, they do develop a learning disability, do you think that how they acted on these tests would have been different?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. Let me tell you the first step that Stan DeHaan is taking with this. He's studying kids with dyscalculia, so developmental disability that includes impairments in doing arithmetic calculations. And what he's expecting to find, and I think he has preliminary evidence to support this, is there's different paths to becoming a dyscalculic. And one pattern is you have a language impairment. And these kids, and he's done beautiful studies with adults with brain damage because of injury that support this very strongly. But he's starting to get evidence supporting this from developmental disabilities work as well. So for the kids who have the language impairment, they're just fine at tracking small numbers of objects and dealing with very small numerosities. And they're fine at dealing with large approximate numerosities. They specifically have a problem with large exact. And that's one kind of developmentally disabled child. But there's another kind, which involves a specific impairment to number sense. And those are the ones where I would think you might be able to pick them up as infants, and it would be extremely interesting to try. The first step, though, I think, is to really map out. At the point at which kids are first learning calculation, what you should see in these kids is no particular problem learning exact arithmetic facts, because language can support that, but major problems assessing relative quantities, estimating, doing those kinds of tasks. And it would be very interesting if that can be found to then try to trace it back younger and see. Yeah.
Kind of two questions. Is this the change from having counted objects to being sense? Is that the same sort of thing as a conceptual shift?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the child is developing a new set of concepts when they learn verbal counting. They're developing concepts set of numerically distinct individuals, whereas what they had previously, they had the components of those concepts previously, but the components were in different relatively encapsulated systems, so they weren't able to talk to each other. I think that's why it was so hard for kids to learn counting in the first place. But once they learn it, they're able to assemble this new system of representation from these building blocks in the original systems. I think that's what's going on.
Secondly, are there implications about any kind of change in the way that arithmetic is taught?
Not yet, but I think a wonderful, wonderful question, both for preschools and for elementary schools, actually. I don't think there's any implications yet, but I'm hoping we're going to go after that. And what I think is that this system for the number sense, this system for estimating approximate numerosities, has been really underutilized in mathematics instruction. Now, of course, mathematics teachers talk about estimation, but what they tend to mean when they talk about estimation is take a large exact problem and convert it into a smaller exact problem. They don't tend to mean use your intuitive sense of number that gets evoked when you see arrays of dots or when you see, you know, you hear sequences of sound, and try to rely on that to give yourself a sense. What does addition really mean? I mean, Our studies are suggesting that before kids get to school, they have a working conceptual system for representing addition, not just 1 plus 1, but these, you know, large number addition. Be nice to, I think I'm hoping that we're going to be finding that there's ways of building on this to enhance arithmetic instruction. But at this point, we're still at the point of trying to map out what these conceptual resources are that kids have when they start school. So it's premature to be concluding anything about that now.
I think there's a numerical system up there staring at us.
Yes, that says we're out of time.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.